Well, on this Easter Saturday, I'm delighted to bring you an edited version of a panel I chaired at the World Science Festival in Brisbane, held last month. The title of the session was Under the Microscope, Pioneering Women in Science, and it was held in the QPAC Hall right by the Brisbane River to a capacity audience of around 1,200, quite a lot of mothers and fathers with their daughters and sons, I noticed, which was great to see. As I'm introducing each of them, you'll hear some music. Now, that's not a mobile phone that hasn't been turned off, but there were some visuals and audio that accompanied the introduction of each panellist, and they all have quite a lot of stories to tell to do with both education and aspirations. So I hope you enjoy listening to this as much as I did chairing the discussion.
Well, thank you all very much indeed. It's wonderful to be here in this wonderful hall and in this final session for the conference, which I know has been very successful. I mean, being put under the microscope is not probably something that sounds extremely comfortable, but we're using that term to invoke what we're trying to do, which is to illuminate the lives of these women you're about to meet. I mean, they're extraordinary women. I've been spending some time with them. They've done the hard yards of science. They've changed scientific direction. They've mentored people. They're still going for all the grants. They're really women whom I think you will find immensely engaging and inspirational, to be quite frank. They're very keen to make sure that people don't think that that's all their story. We're going to invite them to relax and tell us the stories of their formation. What were the tipping point moments? Who affected them when they least expected it to be so? And look, I really think that there could be a lot of wisdom imparted to the next generation and to people well outside science, because I think what I've been discovering, and I think we all will, is that they've got quite a lot to say about the nature of striving in Australia, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing from them and their various stories. So let's meet these women who have excelled in the world of science, and I'll bring them in one by one. Our first guest is Pro Vice-Chancellor of Research and Head of the Applied Marine and Estuarine Ecology Lab at the University of New South Wales. Her research on the ecology of human impacts in marine systems is conducted in such diverse field environments as Antarctica, the Great Barrier Reef, and temperate Australian estuaries. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Emma Johnston. Now, joining her is a woman who's an ARC Future Fellow at UQ and Director of the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Environmental Decisions. She has a particular interest in questions such as where to invest limited resources to protect or restore biodiversity and the role of ecosystem services in achieving conservation goals. Professor Kerry Wilson. Our third panellist is Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research and Innovation and ARC Georgina Sweet Laureate Fellow at the University of South Australia. She was the inaugural director at the Institute for Photonics and Advanced Sensing and the ARC Centre of Excellence for Nanoscale Biophotonics at the University of Adelaide, and is leader in the field, Professor Tanya Munro. And you know Professor Suzanne Miller, I'll reveal the name, Queensland's Chief Scientist, appointed last year, as Minister said, the first female in this role, so a position of great pride. She's also CEO and Director of the Queensland Museum Network, a Fellow of the Geological Society of London and of the Mineralogical Society, of the Royal Society of South Australia, Fellow of the Australian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy and of the Geological Society of Australia, Professor Suzanne Miller. So welcome to you all. Now I'm going to sort of ask you all to tell a little bit about your backgrounds, and then I'll throw it open for a vaguely civilised chat about where we head next. So I will direct traffic, but I'd like you all to feel very free to interrupt. But I want to just get all your voices out. So I want to ask you all, what do you honestly think drew you to science? And I don't expect predictable answers. First to you, what would you say?
Not the predictable ones. You wouldn't get any predictable ones from me, because I know for marine scientists, people often say they fell in love with a dolphin. And that just did not and has not and hopefully will never happen to me. But really what it was, when I think back, it's the methodology that's so satisfying.
There's the methodology.
Yeah, the logic, discovery, etc. But it's really the logic. It's really felt very comfortable with me to be able to interrogate the world and find out how it works using this quite distinct set of testing methodology and the logic behind it. It's extremely attractive.
And how old do you think you were when that hit you?
Pretty early on, actually.
Gee.
Yeah, and I did, you know, interrogate the world myself that way, and I've been known to do experiments on boyfriends and things like that. So, you know, it was a big part of me.
Okay. Journalists don't think like this, I have to say. Now, Kerry, what about you? Was it a similar story or not?
My field is in environmental science, and from a young age, we were always camping and we were always in nature, and I also grew up on a farm, so in regional Australia. And so I just had a passion about how the world worked. You know, why do these species live together? Not deliberately. I mean, they had their own agendas and their own reasons for taking us camping and getting us out in the bush. But that really inspired, I guess, my career path into the environmental sciences.
So you were curious right from the start.
Absolutely, yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. Tanya?
Oh, look, there's some similarities with these stories. For me, I got switched on to science at age 14, year 9, when I had the most extraordinary physics teacher, and suddenly I could see how maths was the language of the universe, and that the logic with which you could build that using maths could tell us anything we wanted to know. We could ask crazy creative questions and build answers, and I found that intoxicating and just beautiful.
Beautiful.
In a way that you feel when you see an amazing artwork. It was beautiful.
And were you fostered in that? This is what I'm intrigued by. I'm very interested in the role of parents, you know?
I think my parents were probably more bemused.
Right. They're not of science?
No.
And Suzanne?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because we all have slightly similar and slightly different stories. But my parents did play a big role. Neither of them were scientists and didn't come from science-based families, but they encouraged my sisters and I from a very early age to be curious and to follow a passion. And we all ended up going in completely different directions, but from the age of 2, my parents tell me that sticky atoms was something that I loved, and I think it was the sound, and they were some of my first kind of phrases, we were always encouraged to read. Books were a big part of our family, and I just could not get enough in terms of scientific books. I probably didn't understand any of it, but I loved it. I loved the sound of the language.
Did you? But you also, you went tramping a lot. The Scots love their countryside, don't they? I think you were sort of right into that.
Oh, look, that's right. I mean, I grew up in Scotland where it rains a lot, but my dad would drag us out probably to give my mum a bit of peace and quiet. I had 2 sisters and we were quite noisy as a threesome, and he would drag us out on what we called welly walks, so that's gumboot walks, because it always rains in Scotland, so it's always wet. But he would drag us out, and he had an innate passion about all things science. And I do remember he took us to this lump of black rock on a beach near St. Andrews, and he created this story about this being a volcano. And from that moment on, I was hooked. Even although I go back now and it's still a black clump of rock, and it is probably one of the least exciting black lumps of rock I could imagine. But he was able to weave a narrative that was just extraordinary to me, and the fact that you could take
and
something...
And was he of science or not?
No, he wasn't actually, although he did become a student of mine many years later, which was a very weird experience, but yeah.
Well, they're fabulous stories, aren't they? And I'll just speak to you all separately about this. So, Emma, you basically found this amazing way of seeing the world. And I know that you feel, anyway, because you were telling our producer, that you had to overcome quite a lot of self-doubt and that sort of plagued you. Well, I don't know if plague's quite the right word, but just tell us how... Did this help, having this confidence in this method of seeing the world?
I think it did. It's all the way through my career I've had doubts about whether or not I can make the next step. And yet I've always done it. And when I look back at why I had the confidence to go forward, there are a couple of factors. One is I learnt not to listen to the self-doubt. I learnt to listen to the people around me who had confidence in my abilities and my application. And so that was a really important thing. It sounds odd, don't listen to yourself. But if you are having self-doubts, it can be because of culture, it can be because of stereotypes, it can be because you don't have role models. So sometimes you have to not listen to the doubt and just charge ahead. And the other thing was just holding on to my what I wanted to do, what I found satisfying. So when in times of doubt, I just said, but do you want to do it? So the first time someone asked me on to an Antarctic expedition and I knew I would have to dive under the ice with the full kit, with the leopard seals, and I'm not a very big, strong person, so I had that kind of doubt and all the other kinds of doubt, and I just went, but do you want to do it? Yes. And, you know, that was what got me through.
And do you look back and see a particular person who had an impact on you or a turning point moment?
Yeah, I've recreated many narratives about this to try and explain how I fell into science, but the most logical one is that my father was a professor of mathematics.
Oh, I see, that helped, yes.
And my mother was a master's in chemistry, although she didn't get to pursue her career in applying her chemistry skills because she wasn't allowed to work part-time. It was the early 70s, and so she became a full-time mum and was frustrated. But both of them loved science. They loved the scientific method. Then you combine that with being outdoors and being in those environments, loving marine environments, the two seem to fit together very naturally. But actually,
what?
In year 12, I wanted to be a science journalist.
Oh, did
so,
you?
Yeah.
Did you?
So, did I make a mistake? Did I choose?
No, you didn't. In fact, my late husband used to say, all these people doing science communication, I don't know where they're going to get jobs. Mm. There are so many people doing science communication now, and you know, as our industry is sort of shrinking before our very eyes. So no, you did not make a mistake. I regret to say you didn't make a mistake. Kerry, again, if you think back to formation and getting you there to, you're saying you're a country girl and observe, by the sound of you were a very good observer. But do you think that you can see moments which turned you, where you could have gone one or other way?
It's interesting. My mother also didn't go to uni, and she left school at a young age to look after her ill mother. And there was never a thought in all my childhood that I couldn't do anything that I set my mind to. So, you know, in terms of enabling factors, that openness to a life and a lifestyle that they hadn't experienced, but one that they would quite happily facilitate and do everything it took to facilitate if we chose it, was quite remarkable.
I know that you believe that adaptability is key. Role modelling, you believe very much in, and adaptability, adaptability and adaptability. You really quite stress this. And what are you getting at there?
Well, I guess the education sector has changed dramatically. The higher education sector is changing as we speak.
Yeah.
And as a scientist, it's embracing those changes and being equipped in your skill set such that you can engage that platform, which is very dynamic. And so at the moment, it suits me quite well. There's a strong need for engaging in end users and stakeholders and industry and business. And that's where my passion lies, is that translation part of science and how we make science useful to solve environmental problems. So we need to be constantly having conversations with people about, you know, what would be most helpful. Absolutely.
So it's town and gown, like, you know, you really do try to step out
yeah,
of your...
we step out, they step in. It's a constant movement. And we design our research around those conversations.
I'm told that you're often described as a woman in a hurry.
I think that term kind of came last year when I realised there was a lot that I could help and deliver for other women and male early career researchers coming through.
Right.
So I felt that in order to be in a position that I could assist and facilitate and also in some ways tweak the academic research environment, I needed to get finished with the career trajectory that is
right.
Academia.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, Tania, of course, people have heard your glorious music. There's been lots of music in your life. Tell us a bit more about that tipping point by the sound of it.
It's lovely hearing your stories. I was quite different from both of you, I think, as a kid. I was very indoorsy, not at all intrepid or good near water. I was very, very introverted, very shy as a kid.
I find this hard to believe.
I was happiest when reading.
Right.
And it was really for me through music and through that desire that comes with music to communicate and to perform that I guess I found my voice, which then through science now I've had the confidence to speak. Sort of thinking back on my background, for different reasons, neither of my parents had the opportunity to finish school. My father grew up in wartime Italy as one of six children, and his father was no longer there, so they needed to go out and work very early. And my mother was one of eight children, and she went to work in the family business relatively young. And the thing I felt that was instilled in me from a very young age was that if you really want to do something, go for it, but you have to work hard.
Right.
And music really encouraged that, because I think a lot is thought that talent is key, but really it's starting, trying, sticking with it, dusting yourself off and getting back up. And I think a lot of that tenacity really helps in the world of science, just as it does in music.
Yes, you have this very interesting observation, because you're a good thinker. In a new field, because, yes, we should say, what is photonics? Because I'm sure I'm not alone in saying I really need to understand it more.
Yes, it's a good question. My field's photonics, which put simply is the science of light.
Right.
So I look at ways of generating light, ways of using light to understand the world around us. Some examples you'd be familiar with are lasers and optical fibres. It is a relatively new field. It builds on the field of optics, which is many hundreds of years old, if not thousands of years old, depending on how you define it. But the ability to understand that photons are quantized and different amounts of energy correspond to different colors of the photon was the creation of the field of photonics. And it's a young field, and it's very exciting to be in a young field.
So you go to this photonics and it changes your life by the sound of it.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing that I realized, I started off, what got me into physics really was reading about things in the field of astrophysics and cosmology and asking some of the really big questions about why is the universe expanding and what is dark matter and some of those wonderful philosophical questions, and then realising that maths is the language that helps you peel that all apart, and I always loved maths. And then for me, when I discovered photonics, the thing that was just phenomenal about it is because it's a young field, I could do computer simulations, I could make something in the lab, and that frees you up to be creative, because you can have a crazy idea much more easily if you can then test out whether it works. Mm. Whereas in many fields, because it takes so long to build the skills in order to do one part of it, you have to rely on someone else to test it if you're a theoretician, or you have to rely on someone else's theories if you're an experimentalist. And for me, that ability to straddle fields really set me on the path I've been on to this day, which has been more about working across disciplines beyond what any one person can learn.
Suzanne, you had this great teacher you referred to in year seven. And what was it that this teacher did?
Well, it was in primary seven, and Mrs. Murray. I think it was also Brian Green last year at the World Science Festival said this, and I think it's so true. You'll remember the names of the really good teachers, and your less good teachers, you won't remember the names at all. But I had this amazing teacher in primary seven, Mrs. Murray. I went to local primary school. It's very small, in a village on the outskirts of Edinburgh, and she wasn't a scientist, but she decided to do science experiments with us in the days when you were probably allowed to do a lot more, like blowing each other up and blowing yourself up. But it was the ability with it for a teacher to drive that curiosity and fun. I mean, we had a riot. Throughout high school, I had similarly inspirational teachers who were extraordinarily passionate and really good teachers. And I think one of the things I find now is we've still got amazing teachers, but they also have to do extraordinary amounts of administration. They don't get to be passionate in their subject areas. And of course, we don't have primary school teachers who have science training. training at all for many of them.
Yeah, they're just great sort of teasers, I suppose, for I'd just like to broaden it in a way to what you think, because given that the festival is designed to draw people into thinking about this, what can be done? I mean, I know, Tanya, you've set up a maternity leave fund.
Yes.
Why and what is it?
Yes, so we call it research momentum during maternity leave, and I guess what I'm trying to address is the challenge that women often face when they go off and leave as active researchers. It's hard to keep your research going during that time. It's really important that the work doesn't stop because science waits for no one. And you don't need to necessarily have your hands on everything if you can have a good team around you supporting, keeping momentum there. So what I've done is put money into create a fund at the university where I work for women who've either, while they're on maternity leave or just after they come back, when they may be part-time, for example, in order for them to have a little bit more resource, because they may not at that stage in their life have grants. They may not have the funds at their disposal to be able to keep that momentum going.
How old is this fund that you've set up?
I've just created it. I've donated some board fees that I would otherwise have been able to take in person.
And you're going to try to raise money from outside
and
sources.
And I'm hoping I can inspire people to contribute, because
Fair
I think it's
idea.
Probably one of the best ways we can keep women really active while not saying to them, give up your maternity leave.
Kerry, does that ring true at all?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the Queensland Government has an Advanced Queensland program at the moment. Again, its hallmark, and the thing that I most appreciate about it, is its flexibility. Because it's not predetermined how you use the money. And you can use it for all sorts of initiatives that are going to further your career. But it's that recognition, I think, and that's what universities really need to start to take on board too, that every individual is different. You know, Emma's personal situation is completely different to mine, I assume, because why would it be the same?
I mean, Emma, do you think that your age group is supporting young women coming through?
There are some great initiatives and there are some great people doing great things to help get more women not only into science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine at the very beginning, at high school and in undergraduate, but also to keep them in what we call the pipeline. But depending on the discipline, there are really clear breaks where we lose women.
Right.
And by the time you get to any discipline at our level, at the professorial level, then you're down to about 17% women.
That's what the figures say.
So, yeah, you don't have much of a chance of getting there. Now, every one of us has a different story to tell about how we made it through. My university had a grant for coming back from maternity leave that I could spend at will. They also had travel money for me to go to conferences or bring a family member to look after children. So there are really good structural things in place in many universities to try and bridge these gaps. However, there's what we're tackling now, a lot of the wicked problems, which are cultural and confidence issues, stereotype issues, implicit bias, where we know that a panel of whatever type of person, if it's dominated by one particular group, will self-select that same group. So we're stuck in a bit of a catch-22 where the professorial promotions committees at most universities are only allowed to have professorial level people on them. Hence, you're going to have it dominated by whoever's in control. And the people who are dominating those spaces right now are mature age white Anglo-Saxon middle class men, and so they are going to self-select without meaning to do so. And we know that there's confirmation bias. All the psychological studies tell us these things will happen. How do we break that?
Now, sometimes they can be those very same white middle class men, because I've seen this, can be the most amazing renegades, and they can support people. I don't know, have any of you had that occur?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. We've all got male mentors, but that doesn't change the numbers, because
it doesn't appear to.
It doesn't work that way. But what we have got in place are a number of really exciting initiatives that will change the cultures, and the Science in Australia Gender Equity Program, which is SAGE, is one of those programs. Yes. And all of the universities, all of the major research institutes and a lot of government sector groups actually are now taking a look at their processes. They're introducing programs to allow people to see their own implicit bias. I have implicit bias. You have implicit bias. We all have biases that have grown up because of what we've been exposed to as we've gone through life. Now, we can actually address those biases by slowing down our decision-making process, by being conscious of those biases and by trying deliberately to counter them. And so there's a way forward.
One of the things we haven't discussed, which we did outside, was competitiveness, because I said I was going to bring this up to you all, because I actually think that what I've observed of the people of science is that they're immensely competitive. And I didn't necessarily mean this as a massive compliment. And I think it's worth naming. You can all argue with me, I invite you to. But I wonder, and of course competitiveness is open to men and women, males and females, but I actually think there's often, in, dare I say, my observation in science, is quite a masculine model of striving, hierarchies, you know, getting in there against versus others, and a very strong pride in prevailing, that I don't find to the same extent in other areas. And I wonder whether you all agree, or whether you think this is something that ought to be ventilated a bit more.
Well, look, I'm going to disagree, only on the basis that my husband was with the BBC as a science journalist for many years, and I spent a little bit of time in the BBC, and I would say it's just as a competitive in your world as it is in ours.
It's different.
But they're both competitive. I think they're both competitive. I think there is a lot of competition. I'm competitive. You know, it's not necessarily with peers, but it's an overwhelming sort of sense, like the numbers. You know, it's wanting to make sure this year's World Science Festival is bigger than last year's World Science Festival. It's not necessarily, you know, sort of competing against someone else or another organisation. It's about constantly striving for something that is better next time. If I've written a paper, I want it to be even better next time. You know, it's a sort of personal competitiveness.
Tanya?
I'd like to take it in a slightly different direction. I think it's a lot about drive and passion. And that's somewhat different from competitiveness. And in science, you know, there's no question that you're vulnerable in the sense that you put your work out there to be critiqued by your peers. And so you have to have the resilience to handle that. But in most fields of science, and I really resonated with what you said before, Kerry, collaboration is king. I mean, you can't achieve anything unless you can work with others. Teams are a very big part of science today. And I work in a space which is very industry linked. So you have to be able to figure out who might be able to use the science you do, listen to what their problems are, chart your direction to be of meaning to them, and collaborate with people with other expertise. So I find a lot of those what you consider traditionally feminine strengths play a very strong role and give quite a tactical advantage.
One of the things that I find fascinating is the way that leadership in general in Australia is transforming at the moment. And all of these values of communication and transformation and being able to listen and having diversity and inclusion are suddenly being shown in empirical studies to be the way to make money and the way to get ahead and the way to get more patents and the way to be innovative. So all of a sudden, the values that we would traditionally associate with a woman in science are becoming more valuable. And that's an exciting thing to see happen.
It is interesting because I wrote a book on this called The Climb, where I interviewed 14 people, including one scientist, and I had to get it out before Julia Gillard's book came out, and so I had other scientists lined up and I didn't get a chance to do it. But one of the very interesting discussions was, and this is really tricky for women, was that at the Harvard Business Review and McKinsey and so on were showing exactly what you've just said. The sort of 11 qualities and characteristics of leadership, and that there was much more building of teams, explaining to teams, blah, blah, blah. Except in a crisis, when the people who are prepared to break eggs and change the rules and start again, who were largely thus far men, were coming through the ranks. And because the GFC was so recent, it was a very confronting statistic and finding. Mm. And a couple of men said to me, what did you put that in the book for? I said, well, it's true, obviously, if they're finding it. And I think until we articulate it, we won't solve it. Mm. And like reading that has really changed my approach because I can see working with people who are prepared to say, throw that rule book out, start again. I think that's extremely hard to do. That takes guts of the first order. And that's a big ask, isn't it? Of maybe you've all had to do it.
Well, I think being a mother, you just get perfect training in that. Because there's crisis after crisis after crisis, and you just have to throw the rule books out. But I think maybe one of the things that reasons that we see that happening is that there are more men in those positions who can then take. And we know that there are more men named Peter, Mark or Paul, any one of them, leading ASX 200 companies in Australia than women altogether. So, I mean, there's just a bigger pool to sample from a scientific perspective. I know that I take on the captain role very frequently in a crisis and I love it. So, but the rest of the time I try to be very democratic. Mm. So it's opportunities.
I wonder if, Suzanne, given that you straddle the worlds of the museum culture, and science, now are there different, can you see different sensibilities there? Does it give you cause to reflect?
Oh yes, and look, I suspect there are a few of our teams in the audience, so I'll be very careful what I say. No, there are huge differences. I mean, in the museum sector, much more female-dominated than male-dominated in general, except, I mean, there are certain disciplines which aren't, but within science more generally, it's the opposite. I think what I find really interesting is that you see, and I spent some time in mining and offshore oil and gas, which is very male-dominated industry. There are really pros and cons. And I think what I would love to see that we strive for is that balance, because I feel incredibly uncomfortable where, not so much in the museum sector, where really the kind of uniting factor is an incredible passion for what people do, and particularly for communicating what they do to a broad audience. And so there's a kind of uniting factor. But I think one of the challenges I find is that a predominantly female, heavily dominated female environment can be equally very, very uncomfortable and very unproductive.
Why?
And I know that's not necessarily a popular view amongst everyone, but I think going too far either way can be very unproductive. And I've found that when I've been in very male-dominated environments, I worked very briefly in South Africa, Southern Africa, in mining. You know, and I was the only one of two women working in a platinum mine at Rustenburg. We were known as the white welly ladies because in those days the only steel toe cap footwear you could get for women in sizes small enough were the sort of Wellington boots that you get in the food industry, which were white. But we had our own toilet facilities, we had our own shower block, we were all shown extraordinary respect. And in fact, in some ways, you know, I probably excelled in that sort of environment far more easily than I did in other very female-dominated environments.
Yes. Could you all say in 10 seconds what you want people to take away from this? Because it's the end of the festival. It's been a marvellous festival. What's the message you want people to take away, please?
No barriers. Just follow your passion. If you're passionate about something, you will get there and you will be great.
And what do you think, Tanya?
I think it's just about striving after what you're passionate about, what you're interested in, and not letting that self-talk tell you you can't do it.
And thank you. Kerry.
Don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something. Like, never. And just, they're completely wrong.
Totally wrong. Just ignore them.
And Emma.
Well, we couldn't be the last session of the Science Festival without saying science is fantastic. If you get a chance to do it, just do it.
Right. Well, look, I really have enormously enjoyed this. I mean, the stories are great, but the passion is fantastic. And the wisdom too, I think. And you can see that not everybody has... It hasn't been a linear experience, which is what I also like, because I sort of don't believe they really occur. So I just want to congratulate everybody involved in the festival. This is the last event, sadly, of what I know has been an extremely successful festival. So thank you to you all for being such wonderful event goers and joiners in. And would you thank, please, for a marvellous session, Professor Emma Johnson, Kerry Wilson, Tanya Munro and Suzanne Miller.
An incredible array of experience, talent and personality there. I hope you'll agree on that stage in Brisbane. The panel I chaired at the Brisbane Science Festival in March called Under the Microscope, Pioneering Women in Science. And I do commend you to the website of the Brisbane Science Festival as well, because there were lots of different activities. And in fact, my colleagues in the science unit will be bringing you several other events from that particular festival, which I'm sure you'll enjoy as well. Well, that is it for this Easter Saturday. Do enjoy your long weekend if you're able to have one. I'm having a rather longer weekend as I'm away for the coming week, so Andrew West will be in the chair next week, which I'm sure you will thoroughly enjoy, and I will come back refreshed. Thank you to our terrific team, producers Anne Arnold, Belinda Summer, and sitting in the main chair, Kate McDonald, and sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. Have a lovely Easter. Enjoy the chocolates if that's you want, and the various friendship and conviviality of the season. News is next. It's coming up towards 9 o'clock.